And Les, the floor is yours.
Great, Harley. Thank you. And thank you to the FISO group for inviting me to come speak. I'll try to tell you to advance the slides since I know everyone's working those remotely. The title of my talk today is Solar Sail Propulsion for Interplanetary Small Spacecraft. And what I plan to talk through are some specific interplanetary CubeSats that are selected and funded by the HEO Operations Directorate at NASA and particularly the AES program. Both of them will use a propulsion system with using solar sails, and I'll run through the fundamentals and background of that for those that may not be familiar with it. And then I'll conclude by, after going into a little bit more detail about those spacecraft, talking about potential future missions that use sails. And I'm fine with questions along the way. I tend to talk a lot, and so if I don't notice that you've got a question, just jump in. So if we can go to slide two. This is basically the programmatic side of what we're doing. The AES program has selected 3 6U CubeSats for flight on the first flight of SLS, the EM-1 mission. There are three. One is BioSentinel, which is the only one of the three not using a solar sail, and that's being developed by Ames, and I won't be talking about that today. The two I'll be focusing on are the Lunar Flashlight, which is a JPL-led mission that will use a solar sail that we are developing here at Marshall, and the project scientist for that is also here at Marshall, and the Near Earth Asteroid Scout mission, which is Marshall-led and developed sail, but JPL is providing the spacecraft bus, as they are also Lunar Flashlight. So those two missions are very, very tightly coupled in spacecraft design as well as the solar sail development. In fact, at this time, we're planning on developing the same sail for both spacecraft missions. And I'll go into more detail about what their objectives are in later slides. If you look at slide three, both of these missions use 6U CubeSats. Our form factor is 10 centimeters by 20 centimeters by 30 centimeters, basically the size of a boot box if you buy boots. And I know in the Northeast you've needed a lot of boots this winter, so you may have more than one box sitting around. But these are pretty small spacecraft. They are also going to use a solar sail, which you see pictured here. The upper right is a picture of what artist concept of the Nea Scout spacecraft and sail when it does its rendezvous with asteroid 1991 VG, which is our primary target, and Lunar Flashlight, which is a long-duration lunar mission, is pictured at the bottom. And again, I have more detailed information about both of these. Just for quick background for the uninitiated in terms of how a solar sail works, I would refer you to slide four. How does a solar sail work? Basically, light has no rest mass, but it does have momentum. So sunlight reflecting off of a large lightweight material like a sail is going to cause it to move. I've got some examples of past missions which have measured this. If you're familiar with geosynchronous communication satellites and their attitude control, this propulsive force for a solar sail is actually a disturbance torque for them, and it's something they have to adjust for periodically in terms of attitude maintenance for large geosynchronous satellites because of the solar radiation pressure. At first glance, people think a solar sail is only useful for a one-way trip out of the solar system because the solar force, sunlight force, would be radially outward. But that doesn't take into account the fact that everything is in orbit. And so the sail craft, when it's launched from the Earth, is in orbit around the sun. And as such, it's got a tangential velocity. Well, if you tip and tilt the sail and you have some kind of active control over its attitude, you can change the angle with which light reflects from it and change the net force vector. By doing that, you can actually get an acceleration along your direction of motion, which will speed up your spacecraft. Or if you tip the sail the opposite direction, you can lessen your velocity, and that allows you to spiral in and out from the sun with the sail. You can also tip or tilt it and change the thrust vector to actually take your spacecraft out of the ecliptic. And there are several pretty aggressive missions that have been proposed in the future that would use a solar sail to potentially crank all the way out of the ecliptic and go into a solar polar orbit. And the advantage of all this is that a solar sail, in principle, is propellantless, so you don't have to carry fuel. And that's the advantage we have and why they were selected for these two small spacecraft, is that these are missions that are fairly delta-V intensive, And it's about the only propulsion system you can fit in a 6U form factor to give you the delta V required to do the science for these missions. So I'll take a pause to see if there are any questions in general about solar sail propulsion.
How much of, yeah, this is Gary Barnhart, how much of your 6U volume does the solar sail and its related mechanisms consume?
Well, I have a diagram later on, but we are allocated about 2U of the 6U. And within that, we will be packaging 4 7-meter booms and an 85-square-meter solar sail in 2U out of the 6U. One thing I need to mention about solar sail propulsion, you are highly sensitive to your orbital distance from the sun, and we are strongly influenced in our performance by the inverse square law. So if we go twice Earth's distance from the sun, we only get 1/4 the thrust. Conversely, they work really well going toward the sun, where you get the inverse square law working for you and you get higher net thrust. And just for an order of magnitude understanding of how small this force is, it's on the order of a few ounces per football field of area. So it's a very, very, very small force, and that means that your spacecraft, in order to accelerate, has to be really, really lightweight. And the figure of merit for these things is usually the aerial density, which is basically how much area and does one, you know, how much area can you cram into each gram of mass. So we really like lightweight systems and a lightweight spacecraft in order to make a sail optimally work. If you go to chart 5, I'm going to give some nods to history. Echo 2 in 1964 actually was one of the first measurements of the solar thrust on some orbit. It was the big Echo balloon, got a ballistic coefficient so that the aerodynamic drag was huge when it was up there. But it, since it's spherically symmetric and reflective, it acted as a sail. And from what I understand, when the astrodynamicists looked at the different forces acting on the Echo, in addition to the atmospheric forces, there were also solar radiation pressure. So that was actually pulled out of the data and measured as early as 1964. Of course, it is fundamentally known physics since the early to middle part of the 20th century that light has momentum, so it shouldn't have been a surprise to anybody. If you go on to chart 6, just also by way of background, one of the first large gossamer structures deployed in space that actually resembles a solar sail was done by the Russians in 1993. They had an experiment on a progress vehicle that undocked from their Mir space station to bring home the trash. But before they did that, what they deployed was a large lightweight reflector. It was a 20-meter diameter reflector. You can see it there in the picture. And the objective was not to be a solar sail, but was to demonstrate to whoever their funding sources were, presumably in the Politburo or wherever, that they could use a big mirror in space to project sunlight onto the surface. Their long-range goal was not a solar sail, at least officially, but a way to artificially illuminate cities in Siberia during those long winter nights. So that was the objective of the Znamya. The deployment test was successful. They had photometers on the ground, and it actually, the light reflected from the Znamya was actually detected on the ground very quickly as the spot passed over the detectors. And you'll see a little bit later that this test and this experiment might have been an inspiration for the Lunar Flashlight Project, which is one of those I'll be talking about today. There was a follow-on mission that the Russians had with a larger sail, but it didn't success. There was an antenna did not succeed. There was an antenna that didn't retract, and as the sail deployed, the reflector deployed, it was shredded. And that was really the end of the solar reflector program in the old Soviet Union and now Russia. To my knowledge, no more work on that was done. If you go to slide 7, I kind of pick up in the U.S. I skip a lot of studies and smaller efforts and go to the next big event in sail development, which was the NASA In-Space Propulsion Technology Project sail development, which I had the privilege of managing that project in the early to mid-2000s. And we built two very large sails, 100 feet in diameter, using two different technologies, one using rigid booms, pictured on the left, and one using inflated booms, pictured on the right. The system on the left was developed by ATK, and Able Engineering. They've had various names. The system on the right was developed by Lagarde using inflatable booms. But these were 400 square meter sails that we took up to Plumbrook because it was the biggest vacuum chamber we could find. And we did ambient and vacuum deployments of these sails autonomously deploying in the vacuum chamber to make sure we understood their deployment, their dynamics, and that these could be packaged into small boxes. And if you look closely on that left-hand picture, there's a little dark spot in the bottom left corner. That's one of the test engineers during an ambient deployment who's inspecting the sail material after it had deployed from the little box that's there in the center. Just for reference, that box in the center on the left we have stored here at Marshall, and it's about as big around as a hassock, very lightweight. A single person can pick it up and carry it, even though it had four 50-foot booms and 400 square meters of sail and the motors and everything else required to deploy it. A really lightweight system. If you go on to chart 8, I've got an enlarged picture of the solid boom sail deployment test. I want to comment that this sail was designed to be repackaged and restowed and redeployed. So it was actually stowed and deployed several times in ambient as well as vacuum, as was the Lagarde sail. The sail material is about 2.5 to 3.5 microns thick, and this particular material will play an important role in a flight demonstration project called NanoSail D, which is coming up on a later slide, which is, again, part of the background of sail development. Unfortunately, there have been a checkered history of success for sail technology, and almost all of it has had nothing to do with the sail technology itself. If you look at the next chart, you see it was called the NASA Space Technology Demo in 2009. There was work to have take one of those two systems that we tested on the ground and have a space technology demo as early as 2009. The program was underway, and there were two candidate technologies for that flight, one of which was the solar sail. But as you'll see on slide 10, that program was canceled, and it wasn't due to any technical issues with the technologies that would have been demonstrated. It was a part of the sweeping up of the various technologies and funding that happened in the years prior to that to pay for Project Constellation. This demo was canceled long before 2009. It was being proposed in 2006 and would have flown in 2009, but that was canceled. If you go on to slide 11, the Planetary Society, who have a sail that's going to fly this April in Earth orbit, wanted to fly one as early as 2005. They actually developed a sail, had secured a launch, all with private funding. It was launched from a Russian submarine with a converted SLBM that was going to take it to space. But if you go on to the next slide, you'll see that on slide 12, their rocket failed. And the sail never made it to space, was unable to deploy, and is swimming with the fishes somewhere in the ocean right now. NASA, then in about 2010, started in 2009. When the big ground program was canceled on the left, there was a lot of sail material left over, and the expertise within NASA of technologists who knew how to build a sail. And it was at the same time that NASA was beginning to work a CubeSat technology, and the Ames Research Center was developing 3U CubeSats for test in space and Earth orbit. So here at Marshall, we approached Ames and collaborated with them. With their 3U CubeSat, within 1U of that, we built a 10-square-meter solar sail that was made from salvaged parts from the big demonstrator in the bottom left. It was put together and assembled into the NanoSail D CubeSat, which, if you look at the next chart, was launched. Chart 14 was launched on a Falcon 1 test flight. It was their third test flight. We thought third time would be a charm and it would make it to space. Unfortunately, third time was not the charm, and as you'll see on flight 15, yet another solar sail demo failed to make space and is swimming at the bottom of the ocean with the Planetary Society's Cosmos spacecraft. Fortunately, on slide 16, there was a flight spare for NanoSail D. That was incorporated into the FastSat bus, HSV-1. You can see pictured on the bottom left this picture. It's a very large spacecraft compared to a CubeSat. It had a Peapod deployer in it with the Ames 3U CubeSat that contained the NanoSail D. It launched into space and successfully deployed. And you can see here on chart 17 a ground picture of the sail as it looked in space unfurled in orbit. Now, it didn't have any active guidance, navigation, and control, but it was a deployment test for a sail from a CubeSat. It remained in orbit for a few months and then reentered. So that was a big deal. That was our first CubeSat sail-like technology demo in space. At the same time that NASA kind of hung up its shingle on sails in a big way for a while, the Japanese, in 2007, began what is described on the next slide, which is slide 18, and that's Icarus, interplanetary kite craft accelerated by radiation of the sun. And these are actual in-flight photographs of a 14-meter by 14-meter spin-stabilized solar sail that, to the best of my knowledge, is still flying in the inner solar system somewhere near the orbit of Venus by JAXA and was the first interplanetary controlled solar sail flight. And I'm still amazed they called it Icarus. They apparently don't know the Greek mythology. That would be the last thing I would have named my solar sail demonstrator going toward the sun. But in spite of that, it was absolutely, totally successful. They are actually in the Guinness Book of World Records as the first interplanetary solar sail. So it's kind of an inspiration for us. These pictures came back because they had a micro spacecraft on board that they kicked off and took pictures of the sail craft, relayed those pictures back to that mothership, and those pictures were sent back to Earth. Japan is now planning a follow-on solar sail mission, which I'm not sure if it's been funded or not, but the last study I saw on this is a combined solar electric propulsion and solar sail mission to Jupiter. And I'm not sure of its funding status. But that was Project Icarus. NASA funded under TDM.
Alas?
Yes, yes.
Ms. Harley, what do we see on page 18? What do we see in the lower left?
Okay, what you see in the lower left is what makes me insanely jealous of the Japanese. In order to tip and tilt your sail, you need to have a way to do active attitude control, which means you've got to find some way to get the sail to shift relative to its pointing vector so that you can get that differential thrust vector and steer. Well, the way that we always looked at it, if you go back to the ATK sail, you know, it was very much inspired by sailing ships. They had little moving masses. They moved up and down the booms, which changed the center of mass of the sail versus its center of pressure, which would allow the solar radiation torque basically to tip and tilt the sail. As you vary the CMCP, you can actually couple that with the solar radiation pressure. You can actually tip and tilt the sail. It's mostly the CM, the mass moving. Now, the Lagarde sail, they didn't have moving masses, but what they had little miniature solar sails at the end of each boom that they would articulate and change the sunlight pressure at the tip of the boom and use the resulting torque to tip or tilt the sail. The Japanese said, we don't want no stinking moving part. So they put liquid crystal devices on board and basically just applied a voltage, and that would darken part of the sail. And a sail that absorbs light versus reflecting it, or at least parts of the sail that absorb light rather than reflecting it, get half the thrust as those that reflect it. So a dark sail quadrant versus a reflective sail quadrant will have different sunlight pressure acting on it, which will allow you to tip and tilt the sail and change your thrust vector. And thank you for pointing that out, Harley. I meant to mention that. So that bottom left corner is showing in highlights where they had strips of this liquid crystal material that they would darken that allowed them to get attitude control of their sail without really having any moving parts like we've looked at. And I think that was brilliant. Although it's a little bit massive, their sail was rather heavy. They need to make it a lot lighter weight to achieve some of the mission goals that they have, but it was an excellent demo. Does that answer your question okay?
It does, thanks.
Okay. And again, I think it was just a really innovative engineering design solution. I'm very impressed. But following NASA's big demonstrators, the TDM program came out from STMD, and they selected the large inflatable solar sail concept from Lagarde for flight as a part of the Taxology Demonstration Mission program. And it would have been a very large 1,200 square meter sail, and you can see that pictured next down here on this chart relative to the size of the shuttle. and would have enabled some really ambitious heliophysics missions. But for reasons that I really can't go into on slide 20, that program was recently canceled. So you can see we've had launch failures, we've had cancellations, and very few sails have made it to space. But those that have both worked, and that was both the NanoSail D as well as the Icarus sail. So getting to today and getting that background away from us, if you look at the next chart, there are a lot of people who are planning on flying sails, and what they have in common, all of these on this chart are going to come from CubeSats. So the really big sails have, just like other technology areas in spacecraft, have been miniaturized and are trying to take advantage of this CubeSat revolution that we're seeing. So NASA has the NeoScout and the Lunar Flashlight, which I promise you I'll be talking about here in a minute. The Planetary Society has privately funded two 3U CubeSats called LightSail A and LightSail B, and I have a chart to describe those. And the University of Surrey in the UK has built three CubeSats, and I'm a co-investigator on one of them, which is the Inflate Sail. And all of these will use a 3U CubeSat form factor and vary in size from about 16 square meters to about 32 square meters deployed area. If you look at slide 22, you can see information about the light sail. They have an excellent blog on the Planetary Society's website, basically chronicles everything they've been doing on solar sail development, and we actually have a Space Act agreement with them to get information as we're doing the design for our systems. Theirs is a 3U CubeSat design. They are not using the same material we're using. They're using an aluminized Mylar. It's a little bit thicker than we're going to be using. Their sail's about 32 square meters, and their first flight is this spring. It'll be in April or May. In Earth orbit, it's not interplanetary. And then they have another flight next year, which I'm really excited about, because it will be a part of a mission that is going to have a small inspector spacecraft come up to the deployed sail and take pictures of it. And we're really eager to see what that looks like with pictures of the deployed sail in space. But that's LightSail B, and that'll also be an Earth orbital mission. And just, again, this is all privately funded. If you go to slide 23, I've highlighted one of the three Surrey CubeSats, because it's the one we at Marshall are involved with, called Inflate Sail. And it's going to be a 3U CubeSat. It's a little bit smaller sail than some of the others. It's 10 square meters. It's got composite booms, and it's got a cold gas generator that's deploying an inflatable boom that actually isn't supporting the sail, but is separating the sail from the spacecraft bus. And you can see here on the picture the different team members for that. But we're supposed to get, we've gotten a lot of data on their design. We have an International Space Act agreement with the University of Surrey. And that flight is supposed to happen later this year or early next year as a part of their QB50 program in Europe. Now, finally, the topic of today, after all that background, are the two interplanetary CubeSats that NASA's developing that will use a solar sail. Let me pause first. Any questions about sail background or other flights that are out there? Okay. NeoScout has as its job to demonstrate a capability for human exploration. This is not a technology demonstration. Sails have been proven and have flown. This particular configuration hasn't flown, but it's not a demo of solar sails. It is also not a demo of doing asteroid missions. We've done that. What it is a demonstration of a low-cost capability to do reconnaissance of asteroids for future human exploration. That's why it's funded by the Human Exploration and Operations Mission Directorate. So the capability that enables is enabled by a 6U CubeSat with a solar sail is what's of interest to HEO. You can see here that our sail will be 85 square meters once deployed. We have a mission duration of about 2.5 years, and our maximum distance from Earth is limited to 1 AU, and that's because of communications issues. Our link margin starts dropping dramatically the further away we get because we're limited in the size of our antenna and our onboard power. and we have to send back data from the near-Earth asteroid, so we can't affect the rendezvous or have any strategic parts of our flight to it occur outside of a 1 AU distance from Earth at any time. So our low-thrust trajectory has to keep things fairly close to Earth to affect the rendezvous. Our propulsion system is the solar sail. Right now we've baselined these 7.3-meter track booms. They're actually a little heavy. They're stainless steel. They look like a tape measure. You can see in the picture on the right. It's almost like taking two tape measures that you get from Lowe's or Home Depot and gluing them together to make the boom. We did that because that's the same boom that we used on the NanoSail D, so it's got flight heritage and a smaller length. And the Air Force has developed these and has used these on a few projects, so there's a lot of heritage with these booms. We're using the 2.5-micron aluminized CP1 that we used in our ground demonstration program, which is basically the same material that flew on the NanoSail D, and it has greater than 90% reflectivity in the optical, which is where most of our thrust comes from. You can see in the bottom right picture a picture of the deployed NanoSail D with the engineering team next to it. And so that is a much smaller sail. That's only 10 square meters. Ours will be 85 square meters. And I have a chart later on to kind of give you a sense of comparison of size and scale for that. But that's the objective of the NEA Scout. Slide 25 gives you an idea of what our configuration looks like, the spacecraft flight system. We are using as much off-the-shelf CubeSat hardware that applies to interplanetary missions as we can. If you ask me a lot of questions about the avionics subsystem, I probably won't be able to answer. I'm more on the propulsion system side. But we're using a lot of technology developed at JPL with their transponder and their rad-hard electronics because we are going to be in a pretty radiation-intense interplanetary environment. We're not going to be in the relatively shielded environment of LEO. And that's one of our big limiters in terms of mission lifetime is going to be the radiation environment. Our instrument is a camera from Malin, which will fit in 1U of the 6U CubeSat, and that is a flight heritage camera. And you can see where everything's packaged in the middle 2U is where we have the solar sail. We also have solar panels which serve dual purpose. During launch and ejection from the SLS, they are the doors that keep the sail within the spacecraft. Once they pop up and deploy, they are our power system, and then they uncover the spools on which the sail is rolled, and I've got pictures of that in a later chart. Now, those that are astute will notice we do have cold gas thrusters on here, and that's because when we're kicked out of the SLS, we're inert, and we're going to be tumbling. So we're going to have to use those cold gas thrusters to maintain control of the CubeSat before the sail is deployed. And we're also going to need some of the thrust, the Delta V, from the cold gas thrusters to help unload our reaction wheels, which we also use on the spacecraft for attitude control. So the whole sail spacecraft is going to be slowly rotating, and periodically during the mission we'll also use cold gas to help us with the attitude control. Future sail systems probably won't need that as we get better center of mass, center of pressure control on the sail systems. But on this first generation interplanetary sail, we won't be completely propellantless, just mostly propellantless. If you go to slide 26, I promised you a size comparison, and there it is. It's pretty startling how much sail you can pack into a small package here. Our sail is pictured here at the top relative in size to a school bus. There I am on the right, and there at my feet are the 6U CubeSat, CubeSats for NEA Scout and Lunar Flashlight that we're packaged in. So you can see that the sail goes into a pretty small package, as do these booms. Slide 27 gives you a little bit more detail on how the deployment system looks. It's a mechanical deployment system. Doesn't have, propulsion system. Doesn't have working fluids. It's not your typical propulsion system. What we're going to do is I have other pictures here. We're taking the sail. We're laying it out on the floor. We're folding it so that it makes a strip. We're doing Z folds to fold it to the strip. And then we roll it on a roller. And we're going to have it tied down with a burn wire, so that it's ready to deploy as soon as those doors go up and we're ready to go. Now, these track booms, Those who are mechanical engineering inclined will realize that these track booms, when they're curled up really tight on their spool, have a lot of strain energy. And NanoSail D did not have a motorized deployment. Basically, once those booms were deployed, they popped out, and they popped out rapidly. And that was okay for a small sail. But we don't want this big sail to pop out that fast, because I'm not sure the sail material would survive the boom deployment. And so for that reason, we have put a motor on board, and we're geared up, and basically we're using the motor to slow down the boom deployment and have a controlled, slow deployment of the sail and make sure we get fully deployed and don't, and the strain energy is not just popping it out, you know, three-fourths of the way and then we don't get full deployment. So we're actually going to restrain it at first using the motor and then finish the deployment with the motor on orbit. If you go to chart 28, you see a little bit more of the packaging that we have here. It's kind of funny. We're flying on a vehicle that's going to put metric tons into Earth orbit, but we're limited to 14 kilograms in our spacecraft. And we go to some of these meetings where people are talking about margins in, you know, thousands of pounds, and our margins are in grams and millimeters. So you can see here the allocation that we have for the sail system, and how we're a little bit under that allocation, so we actually have, you know, a whopping 9.5 millimeters margin in our height, and we might eat into that, but at this point we're not sure. It doesn't look like we're going to have to eat into it too much, although there are some design changes that we might be making. But you can see here the form factor of the CubeSat and how we look relative to that orientation. If you go to slide 29, you can see a little bit about how we fold the sail. I just described that. Yeah, on the far right, you see what the strip looks like after we've had the Z folding of the sail to get it rolled into that long, thin strip. Each quadrant is packaged separately. Once you've got this long, thin strip, in the middle picture, you can see the roller device that we use to roll it onto for packaging in the CubeSat. And on your left is a spool, and on that spool are two quadrants of the sail. So that's roughly 40 square meters of solar sail on that roller that's in the bottom left that you can see there. And that's one of the two rollers that'll be in the a little over 2U allotment of the NeoScout and Lunar Flashlight solar sail on the spacecraft. On slide 30, I mentioned that the Lunar Flashlight was inspired by it may not have been inspired by. I think it can't help but have played a role, but there are good science reasons for doing the Lunar Flashlight. But a predecessor that looked at using a mirror to reflect light on a surface were the Russians with the Znamya. Well, in order to make that work, you've got to make sure you have a pretty good figure on your sail and you can reflect light where you want it to be on the surface, which is going to be key to meeting Lunar Flashlight's objectives. And I guess I've got the cart a little bit before the horse here. I haven't told you Lunar Flashlight's objectives, and I'm already telling you about the technology. But basically, Lunar Flashlight wants to use the sail for propulsion to get it into a low perilune above the south pole of the moon in a polar orbit. They want to get to be about 20 kilometers above the lunar south pole with this 85-square-meter solar sail. And they don't have a camera on board. What they have is a spectrometer. So they're going to take the sunlight when they're flying over the South Pole. They're going to reflect the light into one of the permanently shadowed craters at the lunar South Pole, look at the reflected light, and look and see if there are cometary ice chunks down in the crater, because you're going to need that for future human settlements on the moon. And that's why this mission is being funded by human exploration, because answering the question about how much water ice those craters is a critical question should we ever have a long-duration settlement on the lunar south pole. But it poses interesting design challenges for the sail, which are a lot more stringent than just propulsion. We actually have to not only reflect light into some general direction to get the thrust, we've got to reflect the light fairly precisely onto the surface of the moon so that there's enough reflected light for the spectrometer to get a signal. So what we're doing is we've set up an optical test rig here at Marshall, and we're testing different quadrants under varied tensions so that we can look at what the ultimate flight tension needs to be on the sail to minimize the number of bends and wrinkles so that we can have a good reflectivity, directional reflectivity of light in order to get enough signal for lunar flashlight to be successful. Slide 31 is the one that really talks about lunar flashlight. Again, it's a project. They'll use the sail for propulsion for the first year, which is how long it'll take them to get their orbit tweaked from the insertion orbit they get from SLS to get it into this low perilune. And then they'll start their science orbits, and whenever they fly over, they are going to rapidly tilt the sail to about a 45-degree angle to maximize the light that goes into those craters. And then the spectrometer is going to look for that reflected light. So the idea is to find that water ice that we need for the base that we've all wanted to have on the moon for a long time, if we decide to go back to the moon. Now, the question that always comes up with, Les, this is great. You've got NEA Scout, you've got lunar flashlight. What else can you use an interplanetary CubeSat solar sail propulsion for? Well, the answer to that question is some people have ideas, and I'm sure once we've demonstrated the capability, there'll be a lot more ideas pop up. But some of those that are being talked about are on this slide. One is that you do more reconnaissance of near-Earth asteroids. Our total mission cost is going to be on the order of $20 million. So you ought to be able to explore lots of NEAs for the recurring cost of the sail system, which will be well under $10 million for the not just for the sail system, but for the whole spacecraft bus. You know, this is the DDT&E is folded into that $20 million. We've estimated that if you wanted to buy additional flight units of this and go visit other asteroids, the cost might be as low as, $5, $6, $7 million for the whole spacecraft mission package, the sail, the spacecraft, everything combined, because we will have done the DDT&E for this. You just have to get that ride to something that puts you on an Earth escape, like SLS, and then do the mission analysis to figure out which NEAs are in reach for the Delta-V capability you have for the bus. Similarly, there have been missions proposed, as you see in the top right, to do rendezvous and study comets using a sail. In the bottom left corner, solar sails have been proposed for early solar storm warning, basically using the continuous thrust of the sail to create your own sub-Lagrange flight trajectory so that you're always have a spacecraft on the Earth-Sun line and can warn and provide earlier warning for solar storms of interest possibly to the heliophysics community. In the past, we've looked at much larger sails, but as instrumentation gets smaller, it might be doable with a 6U CubeSat drive sail to help get us that early storm warning that we need. And then there are also mission concepts that have been proposed for anything out of the ecliptic where you can use the sail with a very small spacecraft to get out of the ecliptic plane propellantlessly, not have to use fuel. And also you can use sails to counteract the Earth's gravitational pull and actually hover over the North and South Pole. As the Earth orbits the Sun, the sail orbits the Sun, not the Earth, and stays some uniform distance above the Earth's pole by using the thrust to counteract the Earth's gravity and actually hang there. Now, that's a pretty far out distance, and I'm not sure you can get the aperture of instruments you need on a CubeSat to be able to make that work. But the orbital dynamics looks good, and you ought to be able to do that with some of these CubeSat-derived solar sails. So with that, that completes the presentation I have, and I'll be quiet and answer any other questions folks have.
Thanks, Les. This is Harlett. Got a question. For very long lifetime missions, of which on this last page you've got actually what could be quite a bit. What limits the lifetime of the solar sail itself, not the instruments that it might carry? Do you get deterioration in space? What's the plausible limitation to the lifetime of this particular propulsion system?
Well, the answer to that is there are some limiters. If you ignore the spacecraft components like the radiation hardness, electronics, and all that, the sail itself should survive pretty well impact with micrometeors. I get that question all the time. Isn't this going to be destroyed, by micrometeor impact? The answer to that is the sail material is so thin that when something small moving really fast, like a micrometeor, hits it, it basically just pokes a small hole in it and goes on. It doesn't have enough time of interaction to lose a lot of kinetic energy and dump a lot of energy into the sail. So it's just a little pinprick of a hole. And the sails are going to have ripstop in them, which will be like a thread of Kevlar every half meter, so it acts as ripstop. So over time, and you get a lot of micrometeor impacts, this thing might start looking like Swiss cheese, but that's only the effect that'll have, unless you hit a boom, is going to be just to slightly reduce your total reflective area and degrade your performance a very little bit over long periods of time. We also did long-duration exposure and simulated at the Space Environmental Effects Test Facility here at Marshall of different stale material. And that's why we picked the aluminized CP1, that even though it is a polyimide, it doesn't degrade as fast as something like Mylar or Kapton, right? Those materials over time in the solar UV and the radiation environment basically turn to ash. You looked at like a 5 to 10 year mission life with the sale material. The aluminized CP1 lost a lot of its strength, but it maintained its form factor and its shape. So it could still function as a sale because, remember, there aren't very many high forces on this. So the sale material itself, 10 years, the boom's easily that long or longer. I would guess that the limiting factor might be any ancillary cold gas or techniques for attitude control as a itself as a primary propulsion system.
Okay, thanks. Do other folks have questions?
Gary Barnhart. The Japanese JAXA folks with Hayabusa went to a solar sail that included solar cells as part of the structure. Has there been any traction by anybody else, or you folks thought of that at all, and or using the solar cells as a solar concentrator to when they're not being used for sail to be able to improve the available power?
Yeah, good question. And I think it was, I don't know about Hayabusa, but it was Icarus that had the embedded solar cells in it. Hayabusa, I don't know about a sale on that, but on Icarus, they also did. They had thin film photovoltaics that they generated some power. The problem is that makes your system pretty heavy if you do that over a large fraction of the area, because even though these thin film photovoltaics have gotten lighter weight, they're still heavy compared to 2.5 micron CP1. So yeah, they can. You can use that to generate power. I have to give a plug, we do have another project that I'm involved with here that's called the Lightweight Innovative Solar Array, and it was inspired by our work on these deployable thin films for solar sails, which is basically to deploy thin film arrays of solar photovoltaics that are lightweight and cheap from a CubeSat to potentially give some of these CubeSats hundreds if not up to, several hundred watts of power from a 3 to 6 CubeSat form factor by deploying thin film photovoltaics. So not related directly to sailing, but inspired by that, we're actually working on that and looking at packaging and deployment of these thin film photovoltaics for deployable power systems for CubeSats. And that could be a focus for a future discussion, perhaps, because we've actually gotten internal funding as well as some STMD funding to work on that, and we're actually prototyping those now. I don't know of anybody right now that's looking at using a sail as a solar concentrator. There have been some theoretical papers on that have been done by universities, but I'm not aware of any active work to do that. Although, if you could control the shape of the sail, it dramatically changes the game in terms of multi-use for outer solar system sail missions, where the sunlight may start getting too dim for the propulsion aspect, but as a concentrator, it might enable you to have pretty high power on small spacecraft, fairly far from the sun because you're concentrating the light with that. So I think that's a good, promising area of research and definitely something we ought to be looking at for next-generation sail systems.
Yeah, we're trying to spin it up possibly for the CubeQuest challenge as a possibility. So, yeah.
So I had a similar question on this, controlling the shape of the sail. If you're able to do that to a significant degree, you might also be able to look at things like external occulters using the deployment mechanism. Have you guys thought about that sort of thing at all?
Not my team. I think I've read a little bit about that with some the deployable structures papers that I've read, but we haven't looked into that.
So, Celeste, this is Tom Sullivan. I've got a question about the lunar flashlight thing. It seems to me that even if you pulled this thing taut enough that all of the wrinkles disappeared, if it wasn't perfectly planar, you would still disperse a lot of the light over too big an area for it to be effective. I'm wondering if you might have better luck with a triangular sail, because 3 points define a plane, rather than a square sail.
We actually looked at those trades, and you're absolutely right. We have these four quadrants, and it is very unlikely that all four of these are going to be coplanar. So what that may do is it's going to reduce the amount of incident light on the surface to probably be what we can do from a single plane of the sail. And the wrinkles with the pristine material shouldn't be too bad. The creases will be where we've had to do the fold. And so when we're doing our reflectivity testing, we're putting varied tensions on the sail to try to pull as much of the crease out as we can. We won't get it all out. We'll get a lot of it out. And that's
yeah, and I was thinking that the tension might cause the square shape of it to kind of buckle a little.
It would if you put too much tension on. You're exactly right. And this is a case of, you know how projects are governed by technical as well as cost and schedule? Turns out in order to make this project work, we had to agree to have a common sail system for Lunar Flashlight and Nea Scout because there isn't enough money to develop two different sail systems. And so the sail is going to be sub-optimized for what Lunar Flashlight needs here. You're absolutely correct. If we were developing a sail unique to Lunar Flashlight and we weren't constrained as much as we are on budget, I probably would not go with the four-quadrant sail. But because we have a limited budget and we have to have commonality with Scout, the science team on Lunar Flashlight realized they could live with much inferior reflectance performance and still get enough light to take the measurement, and it's worth it because of the cost savings it'll be on the development of the sail. That's an engineering compromise to the budget.
Okay. Thanks.
This is Rich Vondrak at NASA Goddard. What equivalent delta V do you get for Nea Scout or Flashlight over the duration of the mission?
You know, I'm embarrassed to admit I don't have that at the tip of my tongue. I'll have to I'll answer that and make sure Harley gets that information back out to you.
Okay, and I guess my question was, did you do a trade-off between ion propulsion and the solar sail for each of those missions?
We did, and we couldn't get enough propellant in the 6U CubeSat form factor to get us to the rendezvous with the asteroid. Nor could the team at Lunar Flashlight find another way to do that and the reflectivity. They might have been able to get the Delta V with something else for Lunar Flashlight, but they also needed this big reflector. And I think the solar sail drove them to that for two reasons, whereas for Nea Scout, and I'm sorry I don't remember that total Delta V, but we looked at it and we couldn't find anything close that would do it other than a sail.
Good. Thank you. Yeah, Les, this is Bryce Unruh from Paul. I have a question about the payload volume and mass that you have available on this for the Nea Scout and the Lunar Flashlight. How much is allocated to those payloads?
Basically 1U and up to 2 kilograms.
Okay.
Each.
Hey, Les, this is Joe Williams at Johnson Space Center. If EM-1 slips into 2018, how does that impact the Nea Scout's target asteroid it's going to visit?
We have put together, who knows what's going to happen with your ride on any mission, right? So we've got a whole list of asteroids that are of interest in something called the NHATS database, which are the database of asteroids of interest for HEO and future possible human exploration. So we have looked at multiple asteroids, and if our launch slips to a certain date, we have a different one that we would go visit. So we've got a whole catalog going from launching on time to up to a 2 to 3 year delay, and there are good candidates throughout that whole time period. It's just a different trajectory and a different asteroid. The biggest concern I have is if we get finished and there's more than just a 6 month time that we have to remain packaged. These CubeSats go to SLS EM-1 with a cardinal rule of thou shalt do no harm to the rocket. And so we have to be totally inert and packaged and sit for as long as they tell us we have to sit. And I personally have some concerns if we end up are all coiled up and stowed, you know, for 2 years or something, about what would happen on deployment. So my big concern is what happens to us from a delay, not so much of what it would happen to our science. If we deploy, we have plenty of targets to look at.
You know, have you folks considered the possibilities of a soft pack launch to the station and going from there?
We have looked at different launch options. I'm not sure I know what the term soft pack is.
Soft pack refers to coming up as cargo. Basically, you're wrapped in bubble pack and put into a soft container bag for the ride up.
Well, see, there's an issue here. We have to be on Earth escape for deployment. We don't have, if we have to deploy in Earth orbit, we'd have to be sufficiently high to be out of the aerodrag, say above about 2,000 kilometers, 1,500 kilometers, because this is a big sail, which means its ballistic coefficient is going to stink if there's any kind of residual drag. And it's going to take time to spiral out from the Earth. So we could deploy in high LEO and use the sail for Earth escape, but it would probably add a year to a year and a half to our mission time. And we don't want to do that. And so we're primarily looking for and trying to get rides that give us an Earth escape before we launch. That's why SLS EM1 was just ideal.
Okay. Other questions, folks? We've got time. Any other questions? All right, great. Excellent questions. Excellent presentation, Les. And we're coming up right up on the 4 p.m. hour here in the East Coast. So you filled out our hour excellently, so thanks, everyone, and talk to you next Wednesday.